Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Srimad Bhagavatam 7th Canto, Chapter 13, The Behavior of a Perfect Person, Text 29. We're continuing the interaction, history of interaction between Prahlad Maharaj and the so-called Python Man. Jalang tad udbhavaish chanam hitragyo jalakamyaya megat trishnam upadhavet tatanya charta triksataha jalang tad udbhavaish chanam hitta gyo jala kamyaya mega trishnam upadhavet tatanya charta triksataha jalang tad udbhavaish chanam Dadhyo jala kamyaya Mega trishnam upadravit Tatanya chaka driksata Jalam water
Tat
udbhavai My grass grown from that water
My grass grown from that water
Chanam
covered
Itta
giving up
Agya, a foolish animal. Jalakamyaya,
desiring to drink water.
Mrigatrishnam,
a
mirage. Upadavit,
runs after.
Tata, similarly.
Anyatra,
somewhere else. Archadrik,
Self-interested.
Swata.
In himself.
Translation. Just as a deer, because of ignorance, cannot see the water within a well covered by grass, but runs after water elsewhere, the living entity covered by the material body does not see the happiness within himself, but runs after happiness in the material world. Purport. This is an accurate example depicting how the living entity, because of lack of knowledge, runs after happiness outside his own self. When one understands his real identity as a spiritual being, he can understand the supreme spiritual being, Krishna, and the real happiness exchanged between Krishna and oneself. It is very interesting to note how this verse points to the body's growth from the spirit's soul. The modern materialistic scientist thinks that life grows from matter, but actually the fact is that matter grows from life. The life, or the spiritual soul, is compared to water, from which clumps of matter grow in the form of grass. One who is ignorant of scientific knowledge of the spirit's soul does not look inside the body to find happiness in the soul. Instead, he goes outside to search for happiness, just as a deer, without knowledge of the water beneath the grass, goes out to the desert to find water. The Krishna Consciousness Movement is trying to remove the ignorance of misled human beings who are trying to find water outside the jurisdiction of life. Rasobhai Saha Rasaham Apsukondeya The taste of water is Krishna. To quench one's thirst, one must taste water by association with Krishna. This is the Vedic injunction. Translation, repeat after me, please. Just as a deer,
because
of ignorance,
cannot see the water
within a well covered by grass,
but runs after water elsewhere,
the living entity covered by the material body
does not see the happiness within himself,
but runs after happiness in the material world. Om Ajnana Timanandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militandena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Gunabhana Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasani Guru Bhaktivinoda. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare Hare. Continuing from our previous verse, which was predicted in the previous purport. The happiness sought by the conditioned soul is certainly only illusion, as explained in the next verse. Now, how many of us have the humility to really want to understand that the happiness we seek is just an illusion? Several times I've explained how it is pride that drives the conditioned soul onward in material life. It takes a lot of humility to admit that what I'm seeking is not the real thing. What I'm seeking is just a mirage. That takes humility. Most persons are so stubborn that even though they're suffering, they'll just push on, and indeed try to derive some false sense of self-esteem from that stubbornness, from that foolish determination. Determination is a good quality when you're determinedly pursuing the right thing. But when you're with determination pursuing the wrong thing, this is crazy. Just like, you know, when you're encountering some intersection at a motorway in which one ramp leads one direction on the motorway, the other ramp leads to another direction. And also, some ramps are coming off of the highway, whereas some ramps are going on to the motorway. The ramps that are coming off the highway, you can't go up that. There's always big signs, stop, wrong way, don't go this way. Now suppose you just stubbornly proceed in that way. You may feel very determined, you may feel very impressed by yourself, but you're going the wrong way. But material nature equips you with this false sense of pride. Karanam gudasanga sadasajyoni janmasu. I'm doing it my way. I'm expressing myself. I'm being me. And never mind how much suffering may come my way. It's my learning experience, and don't you try to interfere. I've got to do it this way in order to be true to myself. This is the false sense of confidence that is the sweet benediction of Maya. You can become so confident of yourself as you're going the wrong way and destroying yourself. This is what goes on. It does take humility to question that the things I may hold so dearly are actually doing me in. Doesn't it take some humble spirit to actually think like that? To take a look at it's like yesterday, there was a downpour. So I was watching out the window. Sukadev, he was on the trampoline out there. And as the rain was coming down, he was just exulting. He was jumping on the trampoline and was getting drenched and just... So, someone else might think, probably his mother thought, oh, he's going to catch a cold and, you know, so many consequences. But now he was feeling the ecstasy of getting wet in the rain and jumping on a trampoline in rain. A complete special experience. Not like ordinary trampoline jumping, but in the rain. Very special. So, you all here would recognize that as foolish, although you appreciate that the little boy is happy. But none of you would do that. Would any of you? Downpour. Go out on the trampoline and jump up and down? Like, I got better things to do. But what about our plans for pursuing material happiness? Oh, don't dare question that. These plans are real and they're necessary. They're part of me. They're necessary for my expression. I'm going to do it. Okay, so what if I have to go through some bad times? It's all part of the learning experience. Everybody does it like that. Why should I be any different? As I'm reading these verses in Bhagavatam, I'm wondering how anyone can resist the power of Maya. It seems sometimes to be asking a lot of persons to resist this illusion. Sometimes when I'm talking to devotees, I wonder, how much are they really interested in seeing their way through this? How much are they really concerned with extricating themselves from this mirage? And then I see the power of material nature, the power of material illusion. And indeed, you can wonder, this is so intense. It just seems so normal. There's the body with its demands, the mind with its demands, then society, family, friends with their demands. How can anyone go the opposite way? I remember Srila Prabhupada's prayer upon first arriving in the USA. He was wondering, how will these people ever escape the clutches of passion and ignorance? But then, he said, I know if they'll just hear the message of the Bhagavatam, then the modes of passion and ignorance will be vanquished. I know that if they'll just lend their ears to hearing the transcendental sound vibration, there'll be a change. By Krishna's will, they're put into Maya. By Krishna's will, they can come out of Maya. So this is where our confidence resides. This is where our confidence rests. Not in ourselves. Well, I'm pious, or I'm intelligent, I'm cool, I can figure it all out. Yeah, I've had my experiences. I'm an Auckland boy or Auckland girl. Yeah, nobody's fool. I know what Maya is. As soon as you think like that, you'll be defeated. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Daivyesha Gunamayi Mama Mayadraya, this material energy of mine is impossible to overcome. So difficult. Mamevye prapadyante mayam etam tarantite. But if you surrender to me, you'll cross over. But that's the only program for crossing over this illusion, surrendering to Krishna. There's no other plan that works. There's no point in your taking pride in your intelligence or your experience, your supposed world-wise nature. Forget it. The fact is that those devotees who regularly hear Srimad Bhagavatam and try to enter into its message regularly, those are the devotees who will be able to withstand material nature's onslaught. It is an onslaught. It's a deluge. It's just something going on outside of your control. Just like the cold snap we had a few days ago. In Auckland, the temperature plunged to 5 degrees. In Christchurch, it was -2. So you can't do anything about that. It goes on of its own accord. You just say, the southerlies are coming. The winds are blowing from Antarctica. Anyone here have a program how to stop that? You can't. All you can do is bundle up. So the winds of Maya are blowing. On your own, you can't do anything about it. But if you take shelter of Krishna, then you can be safe. How do you take shelter of Krishna? Mainly by hearing and chanting. If you regularly hear this information that the Bhagavatam is giving you, you'll be vaccinated. Otherwise, if you let this hearing process go to the side, you'll become dull and covered over. Gradually. Without a doubt. When devotees do not nourish themselves properly through hearing, then they become easy victims in the hands of material energy, because material energy is too strong. But stronger than Maya is Krishna. If we take shelter of Krishna, we'll survive. How do you take shelter of Krishna? By hearing the glories of the Lord, chanting the glories of the Lord. Then we'll use our energies for Krishna's service. Your energies have to go for something. Just like one of our devotees was describing. Oh, it was getting a bit too much at work. The boss wasn't good. Now there's a new boss. Things are better. So it's like that. In executing your material affairs, there's austerity, there's inconvenience. Similarly, sometimes in Krishna's service, there's austerity, there's inconvenience. We want a chance to sacrifice our energies for Krishna. That's the that desire is the result of proper hearing. When you hear the glories of the Lord, naturally your heart responds with wanting to serve Krishna, because Krishna is so attractive. What can you do? So I was wondering, how much do devotees take this seriously? What the Bhagavatam is saying, what the Python Man is saying. Do they really try to enter within the understanding? Or do we just want to believe in God? Believe in vegetarianism? Believe in not being a gross materialist? But that won't save you from the onslaughts of Maya. By hearing Bhagavatam, you're associating directly with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's not that you're simply getting information. You're also getting association. Gradually, if you continue year after year, decade after decade, you'll get to the point where you can associate. You can hear Krishna as you turn the pages of the Bhagavatam. You can see Krishna as you turn the pages of the Bhagavatam. It's just like an old-fashioned relationship in the days of the traditional family. The husband and wife, as the decades roll by, would become more and more attached to each other, and more helpful to each other once the stormy periods in the 20s and 30s pass. They're in their 40s. I know many devotee families, after 20 years of being together, when they're in their 40s, things mellow out and they really start to click in terms of Krishna's service. And then it becomes apparent to them, it was good that we stayed together through thick and thin. We didn't divorce. Now we're able to serve Krishna with peace of mind. The kids are growing up. We're really able to focus. So in Krishna's service, in terms of hearing and chanting, there's also development. In the beginning, it may seem a little stormy as your senses rage during your 20s. And then when you get to your 30s, it's not only the senses that are pushing you, but not so crazily as when you're in your 20s. But when you're in your 30s, it's not only your senses that are pushing you, but it's also economic expansion that's pushing you. When you're in your 20s, you can kind of, you know, hey, I don't mind sleeping on the floor. And, you know, it's all an adventure, exciting, you know. If I was backpacking out some, you know, in Thailand or, you know, Malaysia, I'd be doing the same thing. So why not do it for Krishna? It's a big deal, you know, exciting, you know. Just, you know, backpackers live out of their backpacks. Devotees, you know, have their sleeping bags and they, you know, they like that. Few dhotis, kurtas, sankirtan clothes, and some saris, and fine. But as you get to your 30s, then the modes of nature start working a different way. right. So you didn't fall down when you were in your 20s. You didn't lust out, huh? Okay. But still, check this out. Where's your money? Where's your house? Where's your car? And then you start to evaluate your situation under the influence of Maya. Yeah, what do I have to show for my years of devotional service? What do I have to show? And Maya confirms, right, now you're thinking properly. Nothing tangible, no tangible assets to show. So, of course, we're not saying there's anything wrong with devotees looking after themselves and arranging to live a simple life. No, that's not the point. The point is just that there is this pressure, constant pressure, especially when you reach your 30s. Expand your resources, and then you'll be more secure. Then you'll be more fulfilled. In other words, what you're actually saying to yourself is, now that I'm mature, I'm in my 30s, let's just unconsciously, indirectly address the fact that bhakti is not going to satisfy you completely. So you need some other things while you're serving Krishna. Some other things should come into the foreground just so you can progress with your life. You should understand these movements of material nature and recognize them and not become overwhelmed by them. No matter how your life proceeds in Krishna consciousness in terms of your particular style of Krishna conscious activity, your particular ashram, you should recognize the influences of material nature and how they put certain ideas in your mind. And these ideas become very predominant. Just like the deer, this very graphic example, the deer has the idea in the mind. Water's out there. And the deer runs out there after the water without even taking the trouble to understand that right there at the feet of the deer is water. It's just covered by grass. There's a well covered by grass right at the deer's feet. But the deer doesn't know how to take the what appears to be inconvenience to just deal with the water, although somewhat hidden right at its feet. No, instead, it runs. You've ever seen deer and antelope run? Very fast. Very beautifully looking, too, when they run. But where are they going and why? I've seen in nature films African deer. Maybe they're antelope deer. Yeah. Well, it's the same thing. So, when in the heat of the summer, all the water holes dry up. And so, the deer have to travel long distances to get to a river to drink water. And so they all en masse, thousands of deer on the African plain, they start running together. Very beautiful sight. Mm-hmm. Running together to get to the water. And when they get to the water, what happens? When they get to the river? By the range of material nature, the crocodiles in the river know. This is the time of the year when the deer are going to come running to the river to drink. So, just like the deer have their quota to get of water, the crocodiles also have their quota. Nice, tasty deer flesh. So, you can see thousands of deer just crowding the riverbank. Thousands of them. And what do the crocodiles do? They are laying in the water like logs, and they just slowly float to the river's edge. Slowly, just like a log, leisurely floating to the shore. They're expert. Nature's given them that ability. Their body is rough and knobby like a fallen tree in the river, so they just float. So slow. Oh, they're so slow. motionless. They just casually drift closer to the river's edge. And the unsuspecting deer, what are they doing? They're so thirsty. Water at last. They've run for so many miles for water. And now here it is. Water. Satisfaction. They're just slurping up all over. And the crocodiles are motionlessly drifting closer and closer. And then at the right moment, what do the crocodiles do? They're so strong with their tails, they hurl themselves out of the water with their tails, open their mouths, catch the deer by the neck, and drag the deer into the water. All in one motion. Just out of the water, jumps the crocodile, with the mouth open, and falls back into the water, bringing the deer with him. Expertise. Material nature empowers different bodies with different abilities. And the deer doesn't have a chance. The crocodile uses its own strength as well as the depths of the water to finish off the deer. And then all the crocodiles come together and have a party. And do you think all the other deer are watching and say, horrible, they all run away? No, they're all just slurping water. A few of them, maybe two or three I saw, who were right around the deer who got dragged in the water. They kind of, they jump back a bit. But then they just start drinking water again, as if nothing happened. And all up and down the riverbank, which is mobbed by thousands of deer, the scene goes on. Crocodiles floating up, dragging the deer in. But the deer are just lined up in the bouts, just drinking and drinking and drinking. This is how ferocious material nature is. The deer want the water. They're paying a price for it. Some of them are paying with their own lives. What deer knows? What deer that's drinking the water knows? It's my time now. They don't know. They're just drinking, satisfying themselves. The crocodiles creep closer. And a percentage of the deer, that's it for them. So, we should analyze our pursuits. Why is it that we have this feeling that I can't be satisfied with Krishna's service? Yes, we have to maintain the body. If you're a family person, you have to maintain the family. Even if you're a brahmachari, you have to maintain your ashram, maintain your residential facilities, your vehicles. So maintenance is always there. But when we assume that achieving things in the material world are going to actually fulfill us and satisfy us, then we're having big problems. Then we're like the deer that are racing out, chasing the water, neglecting the water that seems to be a little hidden right at our feet. When I was speaking at universities in Mumbai a month or two ago, I was giving them information on the latest scientific studies which show that the more material choices that people have, the less happy they are. The more options they have for material expression and material acquisition, the less happy they are. They gave the example of how in the USA, over a certain amount of time, maybe 20 years, the gross national product has doubled. But the people's feelings that they're happy, they've gone down. And there's a huge surge in clinical depression. So here you have the statistics. Gross national product doubled, but people's happiness is going down, even to the point of clinical depression. This is the trick of material nature. What happens is that there's so many choices to make. When you go to buy something, for example, so many choices. You want to buy a computer. Should it be this brand or that brand? when you make your choice, you're always plagued by anxiety. Did I make the best possible decision? Maybe I should have gotten something else. Because there's so much choice, and because the propaganda is out that you should express yourself in this way by you choosing to buy, to purchase, to acquire, there's a lot of responsibility you feel on your shoulders. I've got to make a good consumer choice. Otherwise you feel worthless, and then people become depressed. I'm not a worthy human being. I chose the wrong toaster to buy. I didn't do enough research on the internet. I got the wrong toaster. I didn't get the editor's choice. I didn't get the top-rated product by all the opinion polls and blogs and on it goes. People are actually in anxiety because of this. So psychologists who are doing these studies, they've divided people into two categories. The maximizers, those who have to make the best choice at every time, and they can't rest until they figured out this is the best thing to do. And then you have those who are more accommodating, that, well, you know, you do the best you can in the amount of time you have and just be satisfied with that. Society today is pushing people to be maximizers. Get the best. You deserve the best. Don't settle for less. Exercise your freedom in the capitalistic society by choosing the best product, and then you are a worthy human being. Avail yourself of all the information. How to buy a house, how to buy a car, how to buy a computer. Always get the best deal. Don't ever make a decision without finding the best deal. Of course, the best deals are always changing and on it goes. In this way, your whole life becomes consumed. So the maximizers are the ones most likely to become depressed. The accommodationists, well, you know, I saw a house, it looks good, you know. There'll be some defects, for sure, but I'm not going to spend my whole year just looking for the perfect house. Those kind of persons are on the wane. Because the way the culture is today, yeah, you've got to be acquisitive and be the best at acquiring things. Then you're a person, then you can hold your head up high with esteem. When you hang out with your friends and associates at the cafe, at the club, you can boast of your prowess. Got a good deal. Really researched it on the internet. Had a connection that told me, you know, inside information, you know, told me a great mortgage rate. that's what's happening these days. Really, you got a great mortgage rate? Wow, how did you do that? Yeah, and you feel a sense of pride. I'll tell you. So, this is what people are being converted into these days. This is the kind of monster they're being turned into. And this path leads to more depression. Because you're always thinking, maybe I didn't make the right choice. Maybe there is something better. Furthermore, because of this false pride, you take more responsibility upon yourself. Yeah. So when you don't make the right choice, you really blame yourself. Oh, I got suckered. I got fooled. Oh gosh. I don't want anyone to find out. Oh, no. I got ripped off. Oh, no. You really take it seriously because you invested so much effort into making the best choice to buy the best thing. And then when it doesn't work out, you really give it to yourself. You really blame yourself. And people get psychological problems from all this. So this is what's going on. The more choices there are, the more anxiety is there. Of course, we know all that from Shastra. What does Shukadeva Goswami say in the second canto of Bhagavatam? You should live a simple life as you're traversing this world of names. The world's actually not complicated. It's just composed of basic material substances, as Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita. But the permutations and combinations are complicated. So you have all these names that you attach to basic combinations of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. So it's a world of names. Shivadeva Goswami says, someone who's actually a kavi, an intelligent person, a learned person, doesn't get caught up in all this and lives a very simple life, knowing good and well that all these names are as temporary as the foam on top of the waves in the ocean. It's a very interesting point to meditate on. The more opulence people have, and opulence means the power of choice, the less happy they are. So the psychologists point out some other things, very interesting, which are completely supported by the Shastra. They say, in terms of happiness and distress, or pleasure and pain from circumstances, one always escalates, the other always satiates. In other words, when you are feeling bad, when you're feeling miserable, that feeling always escalates. It just increases and increases. And when you're feeling good, when you're feeling happy, that feeling always satiates. This is the ripoff by material nature. Some of them are even starting to understand these things, but what can they do about it? The grip of material nature is too much. You can write your psychological arguments, articles about it, but you can't free yourself. So they've actually discovered this, pretty top-notch scholars. You know, happiness, the psychological feeling of being happy, always satiates. In other words, it brings diminishing returns. It gets to a point where there's no more thrill. But the feeling of misery and suffering, there's no satiation. It escalates, increases, increases, increases. So, this is the way material nature works. Then there's something they give the psychological term of adjustment. No, adaptation. Adaptation is the term. Let's say, we know it as chapalasuka, flickering happiness. Let's say you just bought a BMW and you're feeling good driving around often in your brand new BMW. The feel good, the feeling of good, that happiness, that pleasure of acquisition and possession and getting pleasure from this sense object only lasts a short time before you experience adaptation. You get used to the thing and the thrill disappears. We know that as the effects of time. The time factor robs all material situations of their so-called freshness. So they call it adaptation. You adapt. The thrill is gone. You know, for a few days, you're feeling such pleasure driving your brand new BMW and looking down at all the other drivers. But then after a while, it just becomes an ordinary car. I don't know if you've ever had that feeling. You get something new and you feel excited, but then after a while, there's no more fresh feeling coming from that thing or person. This is why relationships break up. Some people are actually addicted to quote-unquote falling into love. They can't sustain a relationship, but they just like the feeling of falling into a relationship, that fresh feeling of discovery, the fresh feelings of interaction, entering a new wonderland. But they can't sustain a relationship. Now, this is actually becoming quite prevalent. That's why there's no more nuclear family, basically speaking. It's becoming extinct. That's why relationships don't last, because people are addicted to this falling into a relationship, like getting a new car or new clothes or seeing a new movie, that wonderful feeling of discovery. But you can't base a relationship on that. Similarly, you can't base your life on the so-called freshness of material experience. There's always going to be this adaptation. You become adapted. That this is not so fresh anymore. This is not so new anymore. It's just the same old BMW in my garage. Then you're off to something else. Maybe if I get a new this, that'll do it. So your whole life is like that. Get a new partner. Or what's common these days, you know, when you and the partner get bored, maybe we have a kid. That'll spark things up. Yeah. Try this, try that. The flavor always goes away. Chapalasuka, flickering happiness. Because of the effect of time. So they call it adaptation. This is very interesting. How the more choices, the more anxiety is there. But what materialistic society is throwing at you all the time is increased choice. You don't have to just go to the music shop and depend on their CD collection. You can go on the internet and you'll have access to millions of CDs all over the world. You just don't go to your neighborhood bookshop anymore and just, you know, look and see what they have and find something to read. You have access to millions of books everywhere, on every continent. Isn't your life successful now? You have the power of choice. Things are progressing. Things are like they've never been before. You want to buy a used car? You just don't go down to the used car lot and pick out a car. You just don't pick up the Sunday newspaper or Saturday newspaper. No. You got to consult so many choices. Look at the internet. Look at all different internet sites. Look at the newspaper. Look at 20 used car lots and then make your choice. That's what you do if you're a genuine human being. Then you can feel good about yourself. This is what's going on. And the result is simply anxiety. It's quite interesting how even material experts can see this. The so-called affluence and opulence simply produces anxiety and depression. Because you take so much pride in your decision-making, your choice-making, and then you become so attached. They say you take responsibility. We say you become attached. My choice, my decision. You've invested so much energy into micromanaging everything to get, you know, the perfect situation. You're really heavily invested into it. And then, obviously, your attachment is so great. And when it doesn't work out, you get so depressed. Oh, I'll do it. This is what goes on. How to live in this world so that you can be immune to these ravages of material nature. There's no better way than to center your life around hearing and chanting about Krishna. Then you can understand the happiness of the spiritual world. As we read in this purport, when one understands his real identity as a spiritual being, he can understand the supreme spiritual being, Krishna, and the real happiness exchanged between Krishna and oneself. This is what we're aiming for. But do we have the determination to stick to it, to get to this goal? The happiness between Krishna and his part and parcel is so extraordinary that even what apparently is distress is simply pleasure for the devotee. Just like in Vrindavan, in Krishna's pastime of subduing a Kaliya demon. This was a complete disaster from one point of view. The anguish, the agony that the Brijvasis went through, seeing Krishna in this great danger. But actually, it was an ecstatic event in love of God. It bound their hearts even more to Krishna. That's the nature of Vrindavan. Everything happens for increasing your bond with Krishna, and therefore your happiness increases. You know, all about the pollution caused in a certain branch of the Jamuna River by Kaliya and his mates. They were living in a section of the Jamuna, an offshoot that was 8 miles wide, and they had poisoned that whole lake. So much so that when wind would blow across that lake, it would carry the poison droplets to the shore and kill any vegetation, trees, plants, or creatures on the shore. The Shastra says that birds flying over would drop dead just from the vapors coming from these poisonous snakes and how they polluted the whole lake. The whole lake even turned like a reddish-yellow color from poison. So Krishna decides to do a cleanup. How does he do that? He climbs onto one tree, a surviving tree. Now there are different spiritual opinions why that tree survived. Some acharyas say because Garuda smeared some nectar on the tree a long time ago, knowing that Krishna would climb that tree. Others say that the tree was dead and revived by the touch of Krishna's lotus feet. In any case, there was one tree still standing. So Krishna climbed up on it and tightening his belt, because after all, Krishna's a man of fashion. He does everything tastefully. Let's make sure. Before jumping into the lake of poison. And then he slapped his arms like a wrestler ready for the match, and he jumps in to the lake of poison. As Krishna is swimming in the water, he's swirling his arms, making such a loud noise, which is actually very symphonic, like the Hare Krishna mantra. Just like when Garuda flaps his wings vibrate Vedic mantras. Similarly, when Krishna's swimming in the Kaliya lake, his strokes are creating the Maha Mantra sound. Now, of course, when Krishna hit the water, he created a tsunami. The water overflowed for 100 yards in every direction on the bank. Because Krishna is unlimited. Actually, you should think, why just overflow a flooding of 100 yards? And Krishna, he's unlimited. The whole universe could have been flooded. The whole cosmic manifestation could have been flooded. All the universes could have been flooded. But anyway, just to show that he's not an ordinary little boy, Krishna had the lake overflow 100 yards. In other words, something out of proportion to the material calculation of his body size as a cowherd boy. So, there's Krishna swimming, having a good time, swimming in the poison lake, and then the snakes go on red alert. What is this big sound? Who has invaded our private pleasure pool? And the leader of the snakes, Kaliya, comes. And he sees Krishna. He notes, very beautiful. Look at that body that glows like a white cloud. Look at his smiling face. Look at his lotus feet. Look at his chest with the shivatsam. He knows Krishna is beautiful. But he's demoniac, he's envious. He can't tolerate. So he immediately bites Krishna on his chest and then wraps Krishna up within his coils. So Krishna apparently is caught within the coils of Kaliya. What's happening on the shore? On the shore, the cowherd boys watching have collapsed. They fainted. Oh, Krishna, life and soul. Oh no, how can we live? Look at Krishna, he's caught in this impossible situation in the grip of this huge Kaliya demon. Oh no, it's all going on amidst this poisonous lake. Even if a blade of grass falls in this lake, it just gets eaten up by the poisons. Oh, no. There were some cowherd men, older cowherd men, nearby, tending the agricultural fields. They had also come and saw it. Oh, no. Everyone's just collapsing on the ground. The cows and calves, they're watching. And they can't even cry. The tears are frozen in their eyes because of fear for Krishna. They just stand there, transfixed, just watching with wide open eyes. Meanwhile, inauspicious omens occur. Earthquakes start shaking the ground. Meteors start falling from the sky. The left side of the men's bodies starts shaking. Their left eyes start quivering. These are all inauspicious signs. You could understand the demigods doing this from two angles of vision. The devas who control disturbances. Yes, there are demigods who control natural disturbances. They wanted to show that even though there's no material danger in Vrindavan, this is a scene of lamentation and great internal devastation. Looked at from another way, the demigods who controlled these disturbances, they were thinking, let's cover Krishna's Aishwarya so that the Madhurya, the sweetness of his pastimes, is presented. Let's make it so it's a real drama, that it really looks like Krishna's not going to be able to survive. We don't want the Brijvasis thinking that Krishna is all powerful. We want to really intensify the scene so that the sweetness of the pastime becomes magnified. We don't want everybody thinking, oh, Krishna's God, he'll easily conquer this. No, we want the drama to become more intense. So therefore, that's another reason why the demigods sent all these inauspicious omens, just to magnify the situation and to cause everyone to forget that Krishna is all-powerful. Actually, the Brijvasis rarely think that Krishna is all-powerful. So the demigods were doing their part to make sure no one's going to think that this is not an exceptional situation. So, the whole village of Vrindavan pours out looking for Krishna, because they're all thinking, where is Krishna? These inauspicious symptoms are happening. Earthquakes, meteors, bodies trembling. Oh no, it must mean that Krishna is dead. He didn't go to the pasturing ground with Balaram today. He went alone. Oh no. He must have met his end. Oh, how can we live? The whole village pours out. Men, boys, women, girls, old people, cows, animals, all racing out of Vrindavan. Where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? He's met his end. How can we live? How do they track Krishna down? They look at the ground for the footprints of his lotus feet. And like expert yogis, they can discriminate between the cow's hoofprints and Krishna's lotus feet. The footprints of Krishna's lotus feet. So they follow those lotus feet. And where do those lotus footprints lead them? To the bank of the Jamuna. And what a sight greets their eyes. Their life of life, their cause of all causes, in the grips of a Kaliya serpent amidst this ocean, this lake of poison. Immediately, the cowherd men, those men are responsible, pragmatic, solution-orientated. They immediately start asking the young cowherd boys, how did this happen? Did Krishna jump in? Or did Kaliya drag him in? Did Krishna want to go in himself? Or how did this all happen? Then they realized the cowherd boys are not replying. They're all fainted, unconscious, laying on the ground. They can't reply to us. So then, meanwhile, Balaram is smiling. Just see what my brother's up to. My all-powerful brother with Ananta Shakti. Just see what he's up to. And what gets me the most is that my brother will never play with me like this in my form as Ananta Sheshanak. Yet he's playing with an insignificant mundane snake like Kaliya. He won't do that with me. Balrog thinks. He's just smiling to himself and watching all the havoc around him and just, you know. But he doesn't say anything. So then, the cowherd men at the riverbank of the Jamuna, they want to go in. That's, they want to save him. But Balaram tells them, no, don't do that. Don't do that. It'll be all right. Actually, amidst all the devastation and amidst all the excruciating pain of the situation, not material pain though, the Brijvasis see Balaram smiling and they actually lose fear. Well, Balaram is smiling. It can't be that bad. But simultaneously, the situation looks so bad. So sometimes they were just relieved. Oh, Balaram's smiling. Obviously, the situation worked out. But then they look at the situation. Oh, Krishna, the grips of Kali in the middle of the poisonous lake. Oh. It's a whole intense drama. So, Mother Yashoda comes. Oh. She is so affected. She's crying, sweating. Her lady friends are wiping the sweat and the tears off of her face, and they're restraining her because she just wants to go right into the lake of poison and rescue Krishna herself. The men aren't doing it. She's going to do it. My child! My child! So the other older ladies are restraining her, wiping her face, and the only way they could pacify her was to start telling Krishna's pastimes in her ear to calm her down. But they also were full of anxiety. It's just that they knew we shouldn't go into the lake. We'll just perish. The men, they're also thinking, let's go in. And Balaram now has to arrange that the men are forcibly restrained. And Balaram comes up with a really clever way how to keep the men from going in. He says, look, you remember what Gargarishi said. He said, this will not be an ordinary child, and that you should take care of him. So answer me this. If you go into the lake and die, who takes care of Krishna? Who's going to be alive? Who's going to be left alive to take care of Krishna and maintain him? Therefore, you shouldn't go in. Balaram's words were effective, so the men didn't go in. They just, you know, in shock and grief at the shore. Then the young gopi girls come. And they remembered Krishna's glances, his smiles. You see in Vrindavan, just a glance, just a smile is so important. So their consciousness is just full of memories of Krishna's smile, Krishna's glances. And now he's in the grips of Kaliya. All they can do is just remember everything about Krishna. So finally, after anywhere from an hour to 2 hours, in the grip of the Kaliya snake, Krishna decides, okay, enough of this. He sees that all of Vrindavan is just on the point of death from grief. It's a kind of ecstasy. It's not mundane. It's not material distress. You have to see it as spiritual ecstasy. Otherwise, you'll be misled. Look, just see how much suffering there is in Vrindavan. Anxiety, acute anguish. Now, it's all a type of pleasure. And the result is, as always, more closeness to Krishna, deeper bond with Krishna. So Krishna waits till that feeling, the bhava, reaches its peak. And he says, all right, enough. He tells Kaliya, you little foolish snake. You've showed your insignificant power. Now it's my turn. And as you know, Krishna starts to expand his body. And so Kaliya has to let him out of his grip. So this is the happiness of the topmost portion of the spiritual world. If you're not Krishna conscious, this looks like distress to you. Where's the pleasure? You want me to go to that kind of place? Is that the supreme destination? With all this agony and anguish going on? Oh, it's the most ecstatic love of Godhead, because it's all 100% Krishna saturated. That is how glorious and great the spiritual world is. Even so-called distress is ecstatic. You can't figure it out in the material platform. Wow, this is ecstatic pain. Ecstatic distress. Now, you hate distress. You hate pain. When I went to the... I had to go to a clinic to get a blood test. And so... Yeah. As a lady was, you know, clench your fist. You know, she's going to stick the thing in your arm and take the blood. And so instinctively she thought, oh, you know, he's no one likes this. He's not going to like this. So she began, like a good nurse, soothing me. He'll be all right. He'll just last a few moments. Don't worry. Yeah. 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 So, because no one likes pain at all. I don't like blood tests anyway, but what was I thinking as she was doing it? This is what I have to do in order to preach, because in order to get a certain visa for Russia, I had to get a blood test. So I had to go through that humiliation. And you know, if you want a multiple entry visa to Russia these days, they demand you get an HIV test. You know, go to the doctor and ask for an HIV test. So she's, you know, sticking the needle in my arm, and she's seeing that I'm, you know, not too happy about it all. So she assumes she doesn't like pain. What I'm thinking is, why do I got to go through all this? You know, how embarrassing, demeaning material existence is. I gotta go and get an AIDS test, you know, just to get on a visa for Russia, you know. And then I began to think, it's for preaching. Just think, it's for preaching. It's for preaching. Just then my consciousness changed. But she was thinking, oh, he's fearing the pain. He's got this inconvenient look on his face because of the pain, like everyone else. But she began to speak to me in a nursey way, you know. The ladies are good for that. It'll be all right. It won't be so bad. What's your name? Of course, I'm the dancers. You know, sannyasi defense sounds. When ladies start asking, you know, what's your name? What do you do? Run your throat? So, we don't like pain. We don't like distress. You know what it's like to be in anxiety. Oh. Can't even sleep. But in Vrindavan, the topmost part of the spiritual world, the so-called distress, pain, and is ecstasy. It's just a different way of enjoying the Krishna. How can you ever understand these things by running after the false water of material existence, like the foolish deer? Impossible. And the crocodiles are waiting. You don't see them, but they're waiting for you. And even the crocodiles are attacking one deer and all the other deer around. Momentarily there's some disturbance. Ooh! And you can see them. They back off from the river edge. 2 minutes later, they're right back. Drinking as if nothing happened. Just like when there's a tsunami, when there's 9/11, everyone's lamenting, oh, horrible, horrible. Then immediately, right back to sense gratification. This is a powerful example that the Python Man has given us. How we neglect our Krishna consciousness, which is dormant. What does Lord Chaitanya say in Chaitanya Charitamrita? Nityasiddha Krishna Prem Saju Kavanoi Shravanade Shuddhachitte Kodayayudoi. Pure love of Krishna is eternally established in the hearts of all living entities. It's dormant there, and it can be revived by the process of hearing and chanting. That's the only trouble we have to take to get the water that's right at our feet. The grass that covers the well is comparable to the apparent inconvenience, you might say, or apparent difficulty we have in developing our taste for hearing and chanting about Krishna. But if you just ignore those misleading feelings of inconvenience and daily dedicate yourself to hearing and chanting about Krishna, gradually your natural taste will come back. Just like Prichit Maharaj, when he's hearing about Kaliya from Shukadeva Goswami, he's eager. Tell me, why? What's going on? Tell me, why was this and why was that? He wants to know about this pastime with great eagerness, because he understands hearing about Krishna will satisfy my senses and make my heart joyful. This is the stage you want to come to. That hearing about Krishna will satisfy my senses and make my heart joyful. I don't need false water in the desert of material existence. So how is it you get that? You attain that level? The hint is given in the first canto of Bhagavatam. Vasudeva Kataruchi Sian Mahat Seva Vipra. By rendering service to the devotee of the Lord, you get Vasudeva Kata Ruchi, you get the Ruchi, the taste for Vasudeva Kata talks about the Supreme Personality God. It comes through service. Therefore, the intelligent devotee wants his life, wants a life characterized by efforts to daily hear and chant with attention and efforts to serve Krishna by serving Krishna's devotee. That is wealth. We want the Krishna Prema Dana, the wealth of pure love of Krishna. We want that acquisition. Then you don't have to worry about, you know, adaptation, satiation, escalation, all these material tendencies. Then we can just hear Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami saying, it's a unlimited ocean, Krishna Leela, Chaitanya Leela, Krishna praying, I just will give you one drop, but that one drop can drown the whole universe. All right, any questions? Now, month of May, marathon time, a chance to deepen your awareness of Krishna. As you become older in Krishna consciousness, you actually always become on a marathon. It just becomes so natural that, it's no big thing. But in our younger days, it's very good to make a special concerted effort to sacrifice. And you'll feel Krishna's reciprocation. I see the results immediately after devotees have been on a marathon. When I'm in their association, it's like a whole purifying wind has blown through. Everyone is so delightful and nectarian. All the mental cobwebs go away. The material desires are reduced way down. The happiness of Krishna consciousness is overflowing. I can see all that. I can feel all that. If you want to experience the presence of Krishna, you take special steps to show that you care for Krishna. And there's no better way to do that than to work hard to give Krishna to others. Then you'll understand Krishna more yourself. And you know really well, if you don't use your energy to sacrifice for Krishna, material nature will take it another way. The one person was telling me just a few days ago, the more money I make, the more bills I seem to get. I said, yes. If you don't use your money for Krishna's pleasure, that's what happens. You think you're making more, but material nature takes more, because you can't have more than what your karma will allow. You can't have more happiness than what your karma allows. So, you take your pick how you want to sacrifice. We're simply asking that you sacrifice forgiving Krishna to others. That's the path of no regret. 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you won't regret that. Oh, well, for 1 month, I really worked hard trying to give Krishna to others. You won't regret that. I tell you what you will regret. If you don't take advantage, you will regret in the future. When you're in old age, you all will get old. You will die, and then you'll regret. Oh, why didn't I take advantage of those opportunities? So we want that you all experience Krishna beyond the theoretical platform. That takes yajna sacrifice. We want that you get the right for reading the books and hearing Krishna talk to you. That takes sacrifice. I remember when I was smuggling books into communist Europe, my motto was very simple. I may live or die, but Bhagavad Gita is eternal. Let me sacrifice myself so that others can get Bhagavad Gita. That's the most important thing. My tiny life, fly like light, here stay gone tomorrow, but Bhagavad Gita is eternal. I know that there are different levels of realization and commitment amongst you all here. It's always like that. Nevertheless, if everyone does their best, how to satisfy Krishna in this marathon, you'll experience the results. The first, as you know, the first week or two is the most difficult, you know, getting into action, especially if you're a bit rusty. But then once you get your momentum, you really start to flow. And then you start to realize, it's kind of nice just forgetting about material desires for a while. It's actually not so bad. I'm still alive. How it can be done? Marathons are a chance to cope with our horrid selfishness. It's really horrible to see how selfish we are. It's a chance how to do more for Krishna and experience how your senses will be satisfied in that way. You're working so hard to give Krishna to others. Don't you think Krishna's going to give himself to you? Everyone's getting Krishna from you, but you're not going to get Krishna? No. That's why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Natajasmanu Sheshu Kastime Kri Krishna. No one's more dear than the one who gives my glories to others. Nor will there ever be someone more dear. So many of you had the good fortune of coming to Krishna consciousness by getting a book from someone. So we just want to repay that favor. Please, once again, start to record. Write down special encounters you have so we can share them with everyone. I'll never forget, someone wrote a few years ago how they knocked on one door and the guy answered the door and they held out a Bhagavad Gita. He said, I can't believe it. He said, let me tell you, I'm a house mover. I see houses all over New Zealand. Why is it every house I go to, I see this book? And now you're at my door. So the devotee said, right, so now you should get one for yourself. He said, I guess you're right, because I move so many houses, I see this book all over the whole country. So, here's the kind of thing you'd like to hear about. And always remember, the more that you have approached people, the more purified they're becoming. Don't make the mistake of thinking, oh, they've seen us so much. The more they see you, the better it is. The more fortunate they are. That's how to calculate good fortune in your life. How many times have devotees approached you? Why is it that we think, oh, we've got to find people who've never been approached before? That's also nice, but we shouldn't be fixed on that. It's nice to meet people, approach people who are fresh, quote unquote. But Krishna will reveal to you actually how everyone's fresh. You just stick to it. Because the more that people have been approached by a Sangha devotee, the more purified they've become. And time again, I've seen that. I've heard about persons getting a book after the third or fourth time meeting a devotee. My greatest lamentation is that I can't be with you out there all the time. I remember during Christmas, I went out. I saw some devotees. I went to Queen Street, and then I went to Ayananda. I got so overjoyed and so ecstatic that I kind of overexerted myself and had to kind of collapse for 2 days. So you all please enjoy this opportunity while you have it. You got to admit, there's something special about Sankirtan. Even if you don't like it or don't do it, you got to admit there's something special about it. Everyone knows that. You can't deny it. So, since there's something special about it, why not get into it? Some of you may think, oh, I'm not distributing so many books. What difference does it make? But you know my story. I've told so many times. 2 years straight, 7 days a week. No results. Anyone here done that? 2 years straight, 7 days a week? No results. You come back, and having sold two or three small books, you know. We called Krishna Trilogy back then, a small Krishna book. You know, one out of three lines, you know. 2 years like that. So I know. And it all changed at one moment. Like our brother Brickupani still remembers the astonishment. In one moment it changed after 2 years. So as I always say, there was no way when it changed. I was going to think I was going to do that after 2 years of nothing. Just no way. It was humanly impossible, which is good for me. Humanly impossible thing I was going to do. I remember I had Godmother's Brigupati and the Darshi. They came there's running up. What's happening? What's happening? What are you doing? You got a new line, a new mantra? What's happening? I don't know. From one moment to the next, everything changed. Then I knew that Krishna is the Supreme Personality. The same me, the same book bag, the same books. One moment to the next, it changed. I know the power that's there. If you just stick it out with this activity, Krishna will eventually bless you. Of course, years later, I understood that. Even before that moment came, after 2 years, Krishna was blessing me because I had met so many people in the street who became devotees and who still are devotees these days. So Krishna was just using me in that way, although I was too young to recognize it then, too young a devotee to recognize. I was so lamenting, I don't have big scores like all the powerful Prabhus. So many devotees, some of them temple presidents, one still been the temple president in New York for 20 years. I met on the street while lamenting, oh, I can't distribute any book. Me, my Krishna sending all these nice people. Yeah. He's also part of the score. So I know what it's like out there on the street, the shopping thing. I know what it feels like.
It really is a chance to build your Krishna consciousness. And all our best people come to our lofts from leading book distributors. That's where the best people come from. Can't be denied. So there's something special about it. You've got to admit.
It looks totally materially oppressive, doesn't it? Me with a bag of books going out on the street approaching people? You never thought you would have done such an act. Never. When you think about it materially, which you shouldn't do, it just looks completely like, what kind of sense is this? Your material relations can't understand it.
My daughter, my son, out there on the street,
buying books. Begging? Of course, they beg all the time in a sense gratification, but that doesn't count. That's different than sense gratification. materially, it looks strange, but there's such a special taste to it. That's the nature of the material world. Glorifying Krishna looks strange. And sense gratification looks quite properly, neat and tidy. So, please take advantage of this month. Put your youthful energies into it.